Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Good morning and welcome to Wednesday's edition of Africa Link. I'm Crispin Mwakideu in Bonn, Germany. Our main stories this morning: Burundi's constitutional court backs Nkurunziza's third term bid, but the opposition disagrees with the ruling.
The Arusha Agreement lays out precisely that no president of the Republic should rule the country for more than two terms, and that is binding.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry makes an unannounced trip to Mogadishu. What does that mean for Somalia?
By going to Mogadishu, he's, of course, meant to send a sign that the fight against the Al-Qaeda-backed Al-Shabaab is going so well that even a high-ranking official of the American government can meet Ali on the ground.
Plus, illegal mining and smuggling in Tanzania. We go behind the headlines to find out how this practice is causing harm to the economy of this East African nation. I'll be right back.
Top story.
No letting up. Hundreds of protesters thronged the streets of Bujumbura on Monday to denounce a ruling by the country's constitutional court. The court has ruled in favour of incumbent President Pierre Nkurunziza's third-term bid. The decision was, however, not unanimous after the court's vice president fled to Rwanda, citing pressure from the government. The ruling did not mention the Arusha Agreement, which emphasises that presidents must only serve two terms. The Arusha Accord is credited for bringing an end to Burundi's 12-year civil war. This report by Catherine Matei is now presented by Sela Oneko.
According to Burundi's constitution, a president is allowed to be voted in twice, and the vote should be through a direct ballot by the people. And this is the problem. After the civil war, Nkurunziza was elected indirectly through the parliament. Domitien Ndayizeye was Burundi's interim president and is now running against Nkurunziza on an opposition ticket. He helped draft the constitution and says that Nkurunziza should not get a third shot at the presidency.
To say today that the president was elected indirectly during the interim period is the wrong approach. The Arusha Agreement lays out precisely that no president of the Republic should rule the country for more than two terms, and that is binding.
The court's decision comes a day after Vice President Sylvere Nimpagaritse fled the country. He told reporters that the court was biased. Claudia Simons from the German Institute of International and Security Studies explains the controversy.
The decision was not entirely free because initially there were three votes for and four votes against the motion. The ruling was adjourned, and during that time the remaining judges were encouraged to change sides.
So what happens next? Many young Burundians are unemployed and have shown their anger in their anti-government protests. Another force to reckon with, however, is the army. Burundi's defense minister last weekend stated that the army will remain neutral, but at the same time, army head Prime Niyongabo announced his loyalty to the president. Opposition member Emmanuel Kengurute is wary of the role of the army.
If the army splits, then Burundi's unity, which was we got at such a high cost through the Arusha peace deal, will be a thing of the past.
Despite all the grim forecasts, there is also a positive side to the developments. Julia Grauvogel, an analyst at the Giger Institute for Africa Studies in Hamburg, thinks that Burundians have managed to build a stronger national rather than ethnic identity over the years.
The only positive thing is that the protests have spread to the areas of Kaminga and Kanoshia, which are Hutu-dominated parts of town. This means that it will be difficult to make this into an ethnic problem if Hutus are also demonstrating against this third-term bid.
Other experts are more skeptic of Burundi's national unity. Many people are still traumatized from the war, and some have already fled the country.
Sela Oneko presented that report by Catherine Matei. So will the court decision lead to an escalation or maybe even another civil war? That's a question my colleague Assumpta Latus put to Ben Shepherd, senior researcher and expert on Burundi at Chatham House in the UK.
The chances of this escalating to full civil conflict are relatively low. And they're low for two reasons. One is that thus far the military has stayed out of the current problems. But the military in Burundi has a long history of deep involvement in politics, formerly dominated by the Tutsi. It has, since the 2005 ending of the civil conflict, undergone something of a remarkable transformation, in that the integration of Hutu rebels that had spent decades fighting the Tutsi-dominated military has gone relatively smoothly. And apparently, it's reported that an esprit de corps has been built, partly due to deployment of the Burundian military into very difficult circumstances in Somalia, where they've had to do some very difficult fighting, has built a level of unity and an increasing professionalisation amongst the Burundian officer class that means that they have thus far remained neutral and have said that they will remain neutral. The second is that Burundi's population, I think, is still very, very tired of the war. One of the big reasons that the transition was relatively successful, that ended in the 2006 elections, was, in my view, that the population was simply tired of the violence. They're overwhelmingly rural. I think it's only 11% of Burundi's population lives in cities. They have, I think, very little interest in seeing a new round of civil conflict. They're much more concerned of issues of day-to-day survival, really.
I just want to go back again to the Constitutional Court. How independent and free were the judges in their decision?
It's very hard to say. I mean, I've seen the reports from the one judge who's fled into exile that initially four of the judges had wanted to vote against validating Nkurunziza's candidacy and were put under severe pressure, subsequently ratified the candidacy. As I said, I think the pattern of political repression of opponents to the incumbent government, be they civil society, be they opposition politicians or the judiciary, has been widely reported on by organisations like Amnesty International and is likely to have been relatively severe. So did they have a free vote? It's impossible for me to say, but it seems unlikely.
And how big are the chances for President Nkurunziza to win the elections if the elections are going to take place?
It's difficult to know with any certainty the level of genuine support that Nkurunziza commands. Burundi's population is overwhelmingly rural, and Nkurunziza sees himself as a man of those rural people. He spends most of his time campaigning in rural areas and is reported to be relatively popular in rural areas. So were there to be a free and fair vote, it's possible that Nkurunziza would win an election. The second aspect of that is that the opposition is fractured in Burundi. The traditional political parties of Prona and Frodebu have both divided into a number of different splinter parties and are not sort of forming a unified platform. Probably the most important opposition party, the FNL of Agathon Rwasa, is a former rebel group and a former rebel group that was organised around a very militant pro-Hutu agenda. That agenda sort of was born in the era of Tutsi domination of Burundian politics through the 70s and 80s. It now makes much less sense when there's a Hutu president as an incumbent. So the FNL's popularity is certainly still there in areas around Bujumbura and to the north of Bujumbura, the areas where it was most active during the war. But it doesn't have anything like the national organisation or the national reach of the CNDD. Finally, there's a very vocal, if relatively small in number, opposition that's drawn from the urban middle classes who've coalesced around the MSD of Alexis Sindihije, who's a former journalist and a very charismatic politician. But again, in terms of the brute numbers of Burundi's population, it's 85% Hutu, and as I said, nearly 90% rural. It's very likely that Nkurunziza will be able to command a majority.
Expert on Burundi and senior researcher at Chatham House, Ben Shepherd, in London.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
Breaking new ground. That's how media reports are describing visits by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry in the Horn of Africa. Kerry will today become the first top U.S. diplomat to visit Djibouti. He travels to the tiny but strategic nation after making a surprise visit to Somalia's capital, Mogadishu, on Monday. His visit to Somalia, though brief, has been interpreted as a warning to Al-Shabaab Islamist terrorists, as well as a vote of confidence for the newly formed Somali government. The U.S. top envoy also hinted at the prospect of setting up an embassy. For more on the significance of Kerry's visit to Somalia, Assumpta Latus has been speaking to Tim Glaouion, a research fellow at the German Institute of Global and Area Studies.
Well, I mean, of course, Secretary of State John Kerry going to Somalia is a much, much stronger sign than meeting the president or other members of the cabinet in Kenya, because that is not the first time that they meet. Hillary Clinton met the new president, Hassan Sheikh Mohammed, in 2013. So it's not the first time the U.S. and Somalia meet
But by going to Mogadishu, he's, of course, trying to send a sign that the fight against Al-Qaeda-backed Al-Shabaab is going so well that even a high-ranking official of the American government can meet with Ali on the ground.
In February, the United States appointed its first ambassador to Somalia since 1991. Why has the U.S. Yes. once again taken interest in Somalia?
Well, it's not necessarily that they have lost interest in the meantime. It is simply that I believe at the moment they are trying to strengthen their fight against Al-Shabaab and Al-Qaeda-affiliated organizations in numerous regions. And they're doing that through a little bit different approach than in the past. They're doing it through the local governments, such as the Somali government, rather than the U.S. government having to send boots on the ground as it used to do in the past.
Now, Kerry's visit to Somalia came after Somalia's National Intelligence and Security Agency has called on media houses to stop referring the Al-Qaeda-linked militants operating in Somalia with the name Al-Shabaab. They say Al-Shabaab should be called rather UGUS, an acronym for the Somali words meaning the group that massacres the Somali people. How do you assess the government's reasoning?
Well, this recent branding of Al-Shabaab, I mean, enforced branding of Al-Shabaab, UGUS, is a new sign that the government is failing to reach internal legitimacy. The problem of the national government in Somalia, led by Hassan Sheikh Mohamed, is not international support. So the visit of John Kerry is not the most important thing on the ground, actually. The problem is that the government lacks internal support. And Al-Shabaab in many areas still has quite strong local support. So the government is now trying to delegitimize the Al-Shabaab movement by branding it UGUS. But of course, the reaction has been swift, and Al-Shabaab and even other just observers have said, well, with the same reasoning, the heavy-handedness of the government military intervention against Al-Shabaab could also be called UGUS.
How much truth is in this statement?
Well, the problem lies, of course, in both sides trying to fight a propaganda war against the other. And Al-Shabaab is quite strong in its propaganda machinery. It has excellent people working on very high prolific videos and messages and radio stations to propose its message throughout Somalia. The government is trying to counter that, and by that we now see a propaganda war of both sides brandishing the other rather than finding civil or political solutions to the problem. So of course, both sides calling the other UGUS is just utterly a false strategy to deal with the problems we have in Somalia right now.
What do you suggest that it should be done now?
All journalists within Somalia are now faced by threats from both sides. If they don't use the word UGUS, they will be punished by the government. But if they do use the word UGUS, they will be punished by Al-Shabaab. So it's further polarizing the landscape in Somalia, and even the journalism is becoming an area that is no longer free for expression. And that, of course, is the opposite direction that Somalia should take now. Of course, it should move into the direction where there's more dialogue, where there's more opportunities for moderate leaders on both sides to get together and find combined solutions rather than narrowing the space in which dialogue can take place.
Research fellow at the German Institute of Global and Area Studies, Tim Glauion. You're listening to Africa Link, live from our DW studios in Bonn, Germany.
Behind the headlines.
Going for gold at all costs. Before multinationals arrived in Tanzania, small-scale miners largely conducted the extraction of minerals. Tanzania, Africa's third largest gold producer, is also rich in diamonds, emeralds, rubies, and sapphires. But illegal mining has cost the life of many people. It has also contributed to massive revenue losses, as Charles Ngereza discovered behind the headlines.
Despite the shocking revelation that up to $1.25 billion, about 2 trillion Tanzanian shillings, is lost annually due to smuggling of minerals and gemstones, as well as tax evasion, the government is yet to put measures to curb the problem. To a large extent, the loss is caused by small-scale miners, most of who do not declare what they get in their businesses. A lawyer from the local lobby, Kalamu na Jamii, an organization which is advocating for natural resources in Tanzania, Mary Mwita, says the government has to stop the illegal practice because it is denying the country much-needed revenue.
As an advocate agency, we think the time has come for our government to stop the smuggling of our resources by enforcing the laws that are safeguarding the mining sector in the country. There are those who are mining illegally and smuggling minerals through illegal routes. This must be stopped. These smugglers should face the wrath of the law of our land. The country is losing a lot of money that would have been channeled to community projects and to improve the livelihood of the people around the mining areas and in other parts of the country. We've seen hospitals lacking medical supplies and expectant mothers losing their lives and so on.
However, the small-scale miners hit back at the government and deny evading taxes. Instead, they say it's a government failure to cope up with the conducive environment that would have enabled them to operate effectively. They also noted that many of them were not aware of the requirement contained in the law and regulation because the vital document have been prepared in English language, which most of them do not understand. Joseph Ndangoya, a miner, told Deutsche Welle that miners like him are also ignorant about the 2010 Mining Act.
First of all, I have to say that we don't have proper markets to sell our mines. Also, Tanzania has to market its mines, that people who come to buy the mines here know how cheap or expensive the mines are. One challenge that we have here is that local traders have little education on what they produce, and the government is not helping them. The government has to make sure that Tanzania has reliable markets, and it has to make sure that our mines are not smuggled outside the country.
Tanzania Minister of Energy and Mineral Boniface Simbachawene confirmed that the country is facing widespread illegal smuggling of minerals, and here he highlighted some measures to stop the problem.
Illegal smuggling of minerals and gemstones in our country is slowing down. Our Tanzania Mineral Audit Authority is working hard to make this happen. We have set officers in all our border entry points to make sure that people don't get out of the country with illegally mined materials. We have to come up with some incentives to miners as a way to discourage this illegal practice in the mining sector. Smuggling is not done by foreigners. It is mostly done by Tanzanians.
And that report was compiled by Charles Ngereza. Let's head to Cameroon now, where we meet the family of Julius Banla Ndi. Julius' wife recently gave birth to Siamese twins. Medical reports indicate the kids' vital organs are intact and they can be separated, but the impoverished parents lack the means to have them separated through surgery. They are now seeking financial assistance for their 8-month-old boys to fly them to the US for specialized treatment. DW's Moki Kinzeka visited the kids in Yaounde and filed this report.
38-year-old Julius Banla Ndi plays with his kids in a special room at the Chantal Biya Foundation in Cameroon's capital, Yaounde. The conjoined twins, Davis and Daryl, are joined at the stomach and play with their four legs and four arms. Julius says he waited to be blessed with twins as confirmed by medics during prenatal consultations. He never knew that the birth of the twins would bring a heavy burden along with it.
I feel as if maybe it's the end of the world for me. When I see them, I cry, say, "Where God, what is this? Why can this happen to me?"
Julius lost his photographer job 2 months before the kids were born. His wife, Evelyn, was paralyzed as a result of the difficult cesarean operation through which she gave birth to the twins and had to remain in their home area of Ndongamantum in northwestern Cameroon, some 500 kilometers from Yaounde. The boys, Davis and Daryl, now weigh 6 kilograms together. They were brought to the Chantal Biya Foundation by Ruth Ali Eno who works for the non-governmental organization Youth and Gender Welfare Association. Eno says that the hospital in their home area was overwhelmed with the birth of the Siamese twins, which is why she brought them to Yaoundé.
Strangely, their hearts and their kidneys and their liver, they are not on the side that they are supposed to be. And one of them, their testes is like found around the abdomen. Some of their organs, like the intestines, are interwoven. Some minor, not very vital organs are also working together. So they are giving them a special food, making sure that they don't have extremes in temperatures, because one person gets sick, it affects the other one.
Julius spends every day hoping that someone will help them raise 15,000 United States dollars to take the twins to a specialized hospital in America for separation. Medic Professor Kokin Domba Paul, who has been attending to the kids, says Cameroon has not got facilities to separate the boys.
Immediately they arrived, we realized they were in fairly good condition, apart from some superficial infections. We took them to the X-ray department and we carried out a total body scan of each baby, so as to appreciate especially the area of the thorax and the abdomen to see exactly the level of attachment of each one to the other.
The conjoined twins have raised heated debates on revamping social insurance in Cameroon, which covers 10% of all public servants. It has also raised the question of why the government won't help those in need. Conjoined twins are traditionally killed in some areas of northwestern Cameroon and accused of witchcraft. But Julius Banda says his children, no matter their state, are a gift from God, whom he believes will take care of them.
Moki Kinzeka there with that touching story from Yaoundé.
Opinion.
And this week's opinion takes us back to our top story. Burundians have defied a constitutional court order that backs President Nkurunziza's third term bid. The ruling made no mention of the Arusha Agreement that stipulates no president shall exceed a two-term limit. It also happened after the court's vice president fled the country to Rwanda, citing pressure from the government. And so we ask, do you think Burundi's election will be free and fair? Send us your opinion either by text message to country code 49160 957 59510. The number again, country code 49160 957 59510. An email to feedback.africa@dw.de or a letter to Africa Link DW 53110 Bonn, Germany.
For more about Africa Link, go to dw.de/Africa Link. Find out about Africa Link's partner stations, send us your feedback in a text message, and sign up for our newsletter, dw.de/Africa Link.
And now, a reminder of our main stories. Burundi is bracing itself for more protests after the country's constitutional court ruled in favor of President Nkurunziza's third-term bid. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has said Somalia is turning around after making an unannounced visit to Mogadishu. We've also been hearing how illegal mining is costing Tanzania a loss in revenue. And there we've come to the end of this edition of Africa Link. Thank you for your company. And from me, Crispin Mwakideu, and the technical crew, have yourself a pleasant day.